From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Home cooking has been undergoing a revolution in recent years, thanks to an explosion of food media and the rise of the so-called aspirational class. Cooking delicious meals at home seems less daunting now than ever, even if we actually don't do it that often. This week, we're talking to recipe experts, food historians, and a food blogging pioneer to see what's going on inside the modern home kitchen and just how far we've come since the days of those TV dinners and meat earlier.
In fact, we've got a chart in Kitchen Creativity, which is the evolution of creativity in cooking, how it evolved from a trade to a craft into an art.
That's Karen Page. Together with her husband, photographer Andrew Dornenberg, she's written some of the most respected tomes on modern cooking today. Karen and Andrew recently released their 11th book called Kitchen Creativity. In it, they offer a culinary education from the world's greatest chefs without relying on a single recipe. I feel like every time I open one of your books, it's like peering into the head of all of these really amazing chefs. And I feel like, particularly this book, I'm wondering, would it have been possible, this book, without all the previous conversations that you've had with chefs for the other books?
Oh, absolutely not. This book is a continuation of the thread that started with our very first book, Becoming a Chef, back in 1995, and all of the classic information they shared with us. And it's a continuation of the conversation that evolved into culinary artistry and the flavor Bible and what to drink with what you eat and all every book since then. And I think what we hoped with Kitchen Creativity was to create a book that would kind of take it to the next level. And we were talking last night because we did an event with Jeremy Fox at Now Serving in LA. And we're happy to get to see that there's now another dedicated cookbook store in LA after missing Cook's Library so desperately for so many years. We think they're a great team, Ken and Michelle behind it. But to really see there, they remember just how it really pushed them and evolved their thinking about food. And I think Kitchen Creativity, we hope, is going to do the exact same thing. It's maybe going to push people's out of their comfort zone a little bit, but in a way that would not have existed at all without any of our previous books.
What fascinates me, too, is just the idea of creativity and the idea of craft. All of us who are really interested in food that has a sense of place, particularly food that's tied to geography, tend to go through a period where we're copying.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So could you talk a little bit about what chefs said about copying? Because there's so many quotes in the book that are exact opposites.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and we open the book with this dichotomy of, you know, sort of the day the world changed in terms of the gastronomic world. And we talked to Jacques Torres, who was actually in the room when it happened, when this conversation took place between Jacques Maximin and Ferran Adria. And essentially, the short of it is that Ferran is a young 20-something cook who was at that point making a lot of classic Spanish dishes, but wanted to make a name for himself, asked Maximin, what is creativity? And he answered, not copying. And the insight was that if he continued to make only paella, then he would never be the best chef in the world because everyone would compare it to their mothers, their grandmothers, or some other restaurant's paella. But if he made food dishes that no one else in the world was making, they would be the best by definition. And so that was really the light bulb that went off for Ferran, that he went back to Spain. He, you know, took all those dishes, the classic Spanish dishes off his menu and started making his own food that the world had never seen before. And when the world's 50 best restaurant list started coming out, he was on top of that list, I think, more than any other chef in history, and created a revolution around the world that was heard around the world. It was chefs that started picked up their foaming devices and their spherification tools and started really creating this and copying
him.
Someone who, you know, I mean, who would have thunk it? So, but it all went back to that notion of not copying. So we divide the world of kitchen creativity into this three-stage process that actually paradoxically begins with copying. Because as you say, you need to internalize how someone else cooks a dish in order to make it your own. So it's like, oh, I get this dish. And then you can turn around and maybe start tweaking. But until you get this dish, it's not yours to do anything else with.
Can creativity be taught?
I think we wouldn't have written the book if we didn't think it could be. I think it's difficult to be taught. I think a lot of chefs questioned whether it could be taught. But I think once they took a look at the book, they're like, oh, I guess maybe you can. I think we've changed some minds already, which is very satisfying for us. But it's one of those things that people think that you're either creative or you're not creative. But when you look at the research, and there's been a lot more research on creativity that draws on neuroscience and other aspects of science where it's studying, you know, how do people manage to be creative? A lot of it is ineffable. You can't really put your fingers on the magic behind creativity, but you can look at the case studies and you can analyze them and you can draw a lot of conclusions that these are some of the conditions in which creativity can take place.
And I also think the muscle has to be developed a little bit. There's a restaurant in Boston, Alton or Harlow, and he'll tell the chefs, okay, we're all going to do a sunchoke dish. And all the crew makes their own sunchoke dish. And so they all come at it very different ways. And then, you know, they'll take their pictures of it, of course. And then he'll taste the dish. And then they all sit down. They all taste each other's dish. And they have a conversation. So I think you can't just, like, wish a light bulb happens. But I think the best chefs, like the chefs at the Nomad or, you know, Alden Harlow will say, well, let's just use this as a learning experience.
And started to train creativity like
right.
a muscle, like
yeah.
the muscle that it is. And I think the more you use it, the more it does develop.
And you think about how critics do their job. They have so much intellectual things packed in their suitcase of tools, and they are looking at whatever it is they're criticizing, literature, art, food, and they look at it through this incredibly complex lens, right?
Indeed. Mm-hmm.
And so is that part of what is your road to creativity?
Absolutely. And again, it goes back to what we call the stage one mastery. You've got to master your art. Even Picasso would say that you can't break the rules unless you know what the rules are. So it begins with getting yourself into the mindset of a chef and learning to think like a chef, how to shop like a chef, how to season like a chef. Because unless you become the kind of person who knows your way around a kitchen, you can't go on to become a to create a new dish and to have it be successful. So you want it, whatever you create, not just to be new or unusual or surprising, which is part of our definition of creativity, but the important part is really useful. If it's not delicious, it's not going to be useful as food. The base of the pyramid in those three stages, and you can think of it as a pyramid, is mastery. It all begins there.
And then after mastery, you say, comes alchemy. Now, alchemy implies something that's sort of just... it's magical. There's something unknown that happens.
Sort of. But I think, for anybody who's knows their way around in a kitchen, who's maybe seen the flavor Bible, really what we're talking about is the magic that 1 + 1 doesn't have to equal 2. 1 + 1 can equal 3. And that's exactly what happens when tomatoes meet up with basil or mushrooms meet up with Pinot Noir or this whole host of other flavor combinations that work well together. Is if you can just get in the ballpark of knowing which ingredients to pair well together, that opens up a kind of alchemy of you can take something common like mushrooms and elevate it to this amazing new level. Or chocolate, which is a lifelong lover of chocolate. I never thought anything could taste better than chocolate. And then I got to be an adult and I had my first dark chocolate dessert with a glass of Banyuls at Restaurant Danielle in New York City. And I was like, oh, my God, it makes chocolate taste better than chocolate. How great is that? And that's the alchemy we're talking about. That's the magic we're talking about is you need to know what ingredients pair well together. And that's a big part of it. So you can learn not just the specific flavor pairings, but where we take it into a new level in kitchen creativity is understanding the combinations of tastes. So fat plus salty plus acid so that you can really switch out different versions of fat and salt and acid, which can come from citrus juice, it can come from vinegar, and each will have, it will be the same property of acidity, but will give a slightly different flavor profile so that you can use that as part of your creativity.
You talk about learning to use imagination, insight, and intuition. And I really think this is the hallmark of this period of culinary development we're in, right?
Sure. And I think this is exactly goes back to your earlier question about could we have written Kitchen Creativity if we hadn't written our previous books? And I think the answer is absolutely not, because I think it's finally after the, you know, it's book number 11, where we're finally at a stage with chefs where they're really willing to speak freely with us. They trust us. They open up to us. And to learn about Rick Bayless's 20-year plus yoga practice that we didn't know for much of our relationship with Rick. And we've been interviewing him from our very first first book, Becoming a Chef, back in 1995. And so to talk with chefs about the role that their very personal practices, like Rick's a very serious yogi and has been practicing for a long time, and the role that that plays in opening up his creativity. Same with Eric Repair, who we've interviewed for several books about his practices at Le Bernardin in New York City, to understand his daily Tibetan Buddhist meditation practice, which is very sacred to him. And he hosts the Dalai Lama when the Dalai Lama comes to New York City, to talk to him about how that plays a role in his creativity and how that opens him up. We've got a two-page spread in the book on that. And some would say, what the heck's that doing in a culinary book? But I think it's a creativity book. And this is a very vital role for so many chefs, whether they are practitioners of the martial arts, such as Joshua Skeens from Zazen in San Francisco is very serious about his martial arts practice, or they're marathoners or serious competitive cyclists like Daniel Hume at 11 Madison Park in New York City. They have these practices that they use to still their minds and to process all this constant stimulation that they get from dining out and talking to so many other people and reading cookbooks and talking to their staffs. They literally need to take that time to really let those ideas ferment in stillness, and that's what fuels their next level of creativity.
That's husband and wife team Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. They explore the wisdom, inspiration, and ideas of the world's most creative chefs in their latest book, Kitchen Creativity. In a moment, I'm talking to a food blogging pioneer. Stick around for a conversation with the one and only Deb Perelman of Smitten Kitchen.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this week we're looking inside the modern home kitchen.
I've gotten a lot more interested in the actual history of food and the way it's made in different countries. That's probably the only real shift in my site, but I still, you know, pretty much write personal stories most days.
That's Deb Perelman, cookbook author and creator of the massively popular Smitten Kitchen website. Before Smitten Kitchen, there was simply Smitten, the blog she started in 2003 to chronicle her dating life in New York. Eventually, her site morphed from anecdotes about bad dates to stories of trial and error in her small home kitchen. Deb was one of the first food bloggers to achieve breakout success with a book deal, and today she inspires legions, and I mean legions, of aspiring home cooks. Her latest book is Smitten Kitchen Every Day. Hi, Deb.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, it's so great to have you here. You started the Smitten Kitchen blog BC before children. How has cooking and your time in the kitchen changed since the coming of your second child?
I mean, cooking, when I first started my site, was very much a hobby. It was something we did for the fun of it, because we were hungry for something, we were curious, you know, we did whatever we wanted. Whenever we wanted, and we cooked the same way too. Kids apparently need meals at regular times. I found with one kid, you could sort of pretend they were your sidekick and, I don't know, make a little plate of food for them, and it didn't seem like a big deal. But when we had two kids, it became like, my God, there are children everywhere and they are always hungry. I felt really surprised by how much work it seemed to cook when I'd always loved cooking so much.
Did you find that they were not as accepting of certain flavors as you hoped they would be?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's par for the course. I'd say overall, my first kid is pretty good. I mean, he'd obviously eat pizza and pasta and peanut butter and jelly like any normal kid instead of more complex food most nights of the week. But we can kind of get him to try stuff. And that made it a little bit easier, because by the time the second one came around, who is, you know, the kid that exists in every family who eats nothing and doesn't like anything that I cook, we were a little more established as this is what we're going to eat anyway. And so it made it a little easier to hold our ground.
Yeah. Tough, though.
Yeah, no, definitely not fun. And also there's like the auditory consequences. So they're kind of, you know, sometimes it gets a little loud. Sometimes we cave.
Let's talk about bagels. It's rare that you hear a New Yorker call out the bagel. And yet you did. What's your lighter alternative?
I just, you know, I don't want to have all of New York, you know, ganging up on me. I'm not suggesting that there's any alternative to a bagel, but I did have fun doing a bagel-ish play on a drop biscuit with everything seeds and putting cream cheese inside it. And it's just a really lovely biscuit, and it's super nice for a slightly less heavy breakfast sandwich.
Do you put the cream cheese in it after it comes out of the oven, or before it's baked, you sneak it in some of the layers?
It's actually right in the dough. You work it in with the butter into the biscuit. And then, of course, I always add a little more at the end, too, because the flavors are so enjoyable together. But it gives a really nice texture to the biscuit. It's got a little bit more moisture and kind of like a richness to it.
So I have a friend who is sort of famous in our group for really hating sweet ingredients in savory dishes.
Oh, my goodness.
What's your take?
It's really funny because my husband's the same way. It's not my favorite thing at all, but my husband is like, can't stand it at all. No raisins, no apricots, nothing in chicken. He really, like, no blueberry sauce with duck. He really can't handle it at all. But my argument is that I think that what we don't want is for it to actually taste sweet when we're done. But if you're cooking, let's say, fruit with vinegar and savory ingredients, it's not going to be a sweet sauce. So I always try to argue my point, not always successfully. But my husband's the same way, and I get it. I do.
Does he cook with you?
You know, he definitely used to, but generally these days I need him to like play goalie with the kids so they're not like grabbing knives off the counters and stuff when I cook. So he's definitely a perfectly competent cook. I have very little doubt that he could follow any recipe successfully. But in general, I do the cooking just because I like it, not because anybody's forcing it down my throat or anything.
It's party season, and in the new book, you have a chapter dedicated to appetizers, snacks, and party food. And you actually make something called kale dust, which I can feel some people rolling their eyes.
I mean, to be fair, maybe it's like 8 or 9 years ago, I made kale chips for the first time. They were having a moment. It was this new thing. I made them, and I thought they were awful. I didn't understand why you would do this to yourself. And so I did what I considered the only logical thing, and I ground it down to a powder, tossed it with some salty cheese and more seasoning, and I started using it as a popcorn topping. And for that, it's perfect. It's a very abstract take on like a pirate's booty kind of thing where you get the green flecks and the cheese and the salt. I love it. I love it on the popcorn. I just, you know, I'm not going to eat a kale chip and try to pretend it's anything besides a dried piece of kale.
Yeah, I still can't believe that they got us to eat so much of it. A couple of the recipes of the book I find really fascinating in terms of your listeners' reaction. You have such a huge devoted following that it must be really interesting for you to put something out there that you think is just something simple, like the dressing that you have along with the sushi takeout cob,
mm-hmm.
and then get this wild reaction.
It is surprising. And sometimes my meter isn't obviously perfect. My God. I mean, if it was, I would be writing a million cookbooks. But sometimes I assume that things are going to be not something that people are going to pick up on or be interested in, and they take off. And sometimes it's the opposite, where I think it's the most easy, obvious thing, and people tell me verbatim that there's no way they would ever go through that effort. But the sushi dressing was one of those things where I hadn't expected anyone else to be as excited about it. And I now am starting to believe that people go to sushi restaurants just for the salad dressing.
So describe how you make it and what you use it for.
Sure. So you start with a carrot, which is sort of fun, with ginger and carrot. And of course, I might be doing the ingredients out of order, but it's chopped ginger, chopped garlic, a carrot, and you grind the carrot until it's as finely chopped as you can get it in your food processor or blender. And then you add miso, rice vinegar, and toasted sesame oil. And the effect is just, it's so good. It's such a delicious salad dressing. And in general, I mean, if you get it when you're doing like sushi takeout or at a chain, I'd say sushi restaurant, this is probably not like the finest sushi in the land here. It comes with a very simple, like 3 leaves of iceberg, wedge of tomato kind of salad. But I wanted to find a way to make more of it and eat more of it. So I decided to make a cob of all the things that I like to put the dressing on, which included avocado, edamame, some radish, and cucumbers and more. And it becomes much more of a meal.
One of the things you have on your website, which I have always loved, is on every page where you present something new, you have these links to what was happening on that day a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. Looking back at 2017 in terms of food, where do you think we went? Or at least where did you go in your kitchen?
Oh, so interesting. I feel like, you know, it's so hard. You always worry that you're in some sort of, you know, urban bubble where, you know, you think everyone's cooking what they're doing in Brooklyn or whatever, or at least in my case. But I feel like we've gotten a lot more vegetable forward, and I love it. I think that we're all, I mean, of course, you've got this gluten-free thing that's been going on for years, not thing. I mean, for some people, it's a medical, other people, it's a dietary choice. I feel like vegetables are taking center stage in a lot more restaurants, and you can get a lot more meatless options. And I think that's great for everyone. I feel like I'm seeing a lot of vegan comfort food too, where I think if, like in the 70s and 80s, we thought of vegan food as like being very healthy and wholesome, probably giving away my age here. But I think that what I'm seeing now is like, it's sometimes it's fried in a rich sauce, whatever. It's not purely just for reasons of eating light.
So I'm sure you get asked this question a lot, but I have to ask you, the internet on its own has just changed so much since you began your site in 2003. I mean, that's hard. It's like 15 years ago. That's crazy.
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
I know. I'm like a blogging grandmother.
And so many food blogs have come and have gone away. How have your writing habits changed over the years as you've become more of a public personality and what people would call an author rather than a blogger?
It's very interesting to me because blogging was always considered a style of writing, but to me it was always just a way to publish. You know, it's self-publishing. You don't have a job at a magazine. Here's your magazine like website that you can create for yourself. That said, my blog and most other early blogs, a lot of them had this, you know, they were a little bit of an online diary where you'd write about your life. And I've always done that. I would say these days, I still write about my life all the time, but I would say I've taken a lot more interest in the food. I really have gotten much more interested in the background of a dish and not just, you know, talking about hummus or tahini or this, you know, the origin of like, you know, a you know street cart chicken in New York, but really reading up in the background and kind of bringing that in. I think I've gotten a lot more interested in the actual history of food and the way it's made in different countries.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That's Deb Pearlman, creator of Smitten Kitchen. Her latest book is Smitten Kitchen Every Day. Visit the Good Food blog for her recipe for chocolate pecan slab pie. Yum. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Stay tuned for a big announcement next week about KCRW's pie contest. Now that we've heard from some leading lights of kitchen creativity, we're stepping back for a historical view, specifically how home cooking has changed over the years.
I had a great interchange with somebody who I was trying to recruit him to be part of the study. And he said, okay, so you want to come over to my house and watch me take the pizza out of the box and put it in the oven. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to do that.
That's nutrition scholar Amy Trubeck. We've been talking about her remarkable study that's the subject of her new book. It's called Making Modern Meals, How Americans Cook Today. In it, she explains how making meals at home went from being a chore to a choice and finally to a creative endeavor.
There's a number of changes that have occurred. Some of these are social transformations in the organization of American society. And in many ways, we have liberated women from the notion that it is a duty, their duty. It is part of their gender, their biology, that they must be the cooks, the home cooks. And we now have a much more fluid relationship to who needs to do the cooking. And what that has done has, I think, in many ways created new means by which other people cook on our behalf. And therefore, what we have a lot of is a lot more food that's prepared for us outside of the home. It doesn't mean that we didn't have other people cook for us before, let's say, the 1960s. In fact, if you had money, you did have a domestic cook. But what happens in the 50s and 60s, and it's really taken place by 1970, is you have the decline in domestic service as a major occupation for people who do what you might call paid or professional cooking. And you have this huge rise in sort of what we call now food service. So we have not just the high-end chefs in restaurants and not just the people who cook at the roadside diners, but we also have the people that cook in hospitals in schools and in commissary kitchens. And so we have this explosion in the sort of profession of cooks.
In your book, you reference how Michael Pollan sort of talks about the way we outsourced our food preparation, like you've just mentioned, as being the decline of something fundamental, and that the role of cooking, sort of reasserting the primacy of it in the domestic sphere, gives us something back. But that presupposes a certain set of values, does it not?
I started noticing, and I would say this was as long ago as maybe 15, 12, 10 years ago, I just noticed just a lot of discussion in sort of in media and talking about food and what was happening with food, and particularly what was happening with an idea of our public health in relationship to the rising rates of overweight and obesity, and that there was a lot of people were looking for some kind of cause and effect. You know, we have a rising rates of obesity because of processed food, or we have rising rates of obesity because we don't sit down to family dinner anymore, or because we don't cook anymore. And then it became sort of, not only do we not cook anymore, but we're having a decline in culinary skill and knowledge. And so it was also sort of a crisis that wasn't just a health crisis, but it was a cultural crisis. And so I was very interested in that discourse, because as somebody who's been both involved in working in food and working in food service and teaching at a culinary school, but then also trained as an anthropologist to think about, you know, how we live our everyday lives and how culture gets made and shaped in everyday life, I just wasn't sure if it was that clear cut.
You actually did a video study, an ethnographic study, would you say, of people cooking dinner in their homes. So why did you do that, and what did you find?
I knew when I started the project that I wanted to observe people cooking, because I felt like if we were really going to document a decline in cooking skill and knowledge, we actually had to watch people doing it. We couldn't just assume that this decline was happening because we did have rising amount of food being prepared outside of the home and a rising amount of processed food available. I felt like we had to document it. And so I did want to do observational work, which is what I was trained to do. And I have a colleague, David Sutton, and he was also doing some work on cooking, and he had started doing videotaping. And I thought, oh, that is such a great idea. So then I just took it on and we developed this project. In the end, there was about 30 people that we videotaped, and most of them we videotaped more than once cooking in their homes. It wasn't a setup in the sense of we didn't give them the ingredients, we didn't do anything. We just said, we want to come in and we want you to make a typical dinner, and we're going to talk to you and videotape you while you're doing it.
Could you describe the interaction that goes on between a young girl named Isabel and her father around squeezing a lemon, juicing a lemon?
I'll talk about this in a little detail too, because this was one of these moments where I just was so happy that I had done the video, because if I had only taken notes, I never would have captured this. I did the video, and I was in with this family, and there were four small children, and I was videotaping the parents making a meal in their home. And I'm sure because I was there, they got really interested in them making the meal. So they were young. This girl was, I think, 5 or 6 at the time. And so she wanted to help with the meal. And the father was, you know, busy, and he was distracted, and he was trying to saute the onions. And, you know, he was trying to deal with some other things. But she's like, Daddy, Daddy, please, you know, can I help? Can I help? And he's like, okay, take this lemon and juice this lemon. And it's just a pure happenstance that I happened to catch this on camera. I happened to catch her basically taking the whole lemon and then opening up the sort of, you know, hinged metal, sort of old-fashioned metal juicer, and just not really knowing what to do. So she just puts the whole lemon in the bottom and then tries to push the top part down. And there's like a 10-second gap, and then she says, Daddy, it's not working. And then he looks at it and he realizes that he never told her that she had to cut the lemon in half first and then put it on the top of the juicer. And so then he tells her that, and then she sort of gets it, but he also didn't tell her she had to rotate the lemon. And it's just so fascinating, because you realize how many tiny little actions that you actually do when you're cooking. And if you've never done it before, And if you don't get the right kind of instruction, it can be quite difficult.
Yeah, really, really interesting. You talk about how cooking for your family in the 50s was an understood task, and there was a lot of emphasis on being a great home cook. How has that changed?
It seems to me that a woman's identity is no longer, in a sense, made or broken by her sort of success as a hostess or as the maker of great and beautiful meals. I do think that most of the women I know don't feel that as being central to their sense of their identity as either a mother or a wife or anything else. I think, though, that we still use food and sort of how we interact with food as a means of differentiating ourselves from other people and either feeling better or worse. You know, something as a human species, we're very easily can do that. And so there's still a lot of sort of moralizing around food and what people give to their families. And now it's increasingly around health. That I find that I feel like the difference in between the 50s and now is that women feel like they have to provide healthy meals for their families. They don't necessarily have to cook it all themselves, but that's their job. Not necessarily making a beautiful meal that everybody sits down to and that they've done all the labor on it.
You also say that making meals did not stop being part and parcel of women's everyday work over the course of the 20th century, but means and modes of completing the task underwent transformations and became more externalized.
One of the things that you do see that has happened is that women, what they seem to have remained is what I call like the gatekeeper. They're the nutritional gatekeepers and the food gatekeepers. So when it comes to the idea of who's going to make the decisions, who's going to think about the logistics of the shopping and the cooking and what people need to eat and what has to happen on any given day, it remains primarily women's work to do that. It is less often the case that it's also the woman's job to do all of the actual practical actions around that. So increasingly, you'll find couples where one person does the shopping and the other person does the cooking, or one person does the cleaning up and the other one person does the setting of the table and the this and the that. And so that has really been changed. But the other thing that I've noticed is a huge change is that no one in families, I think, sees it's their absolute job to make sure that the planning happens, that they're in charge of all the planning. And so what you see that has changed, I think, in a pretty serious way over the last 75 years is that we're much more ad hoc in how we cook. So we might decide what we're going to eat for dinner as we leave work and we're driving to the Whole Foods and then we're going to see what's there and then we're going to bring it home and cook it. Whereas, you know, there is a lot of evidence that women, as part of their women's work and their care work in earlier times, you know, they would start the week knowing what they were doing for the rest of the week. And that seems to have really disappeared.
That's Amy Trubeck. She's Associate Professor of Nutrition and Food Science at the University of Vermont. Her new book is called Making Modern Meals, How Americans Cook Today. In a minute, a look at the idea of simple, easy home cooking and why some people are pushing back. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. This week, we're looking at the state of home cooking today. With food TV and newfangled gadgets, home cooking's a booming industry. But lately, there's been pushback on the idea of easy home cooking. I'm joined by food historian Rachel Lawden, who has her own ideas about why it's so hard to throw together a quick and delicious meal during the week. Hi there.
Hello, Evelyn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm so glad to have you. I also find the words quick and easy when they're couched within the context of a cookbook and promises of a 30-minute turnaround completely unrealistic.
Absolutely.
But it seems like that's the new norm, and that people who are cooks who maybe aren't really comfortable cooks and who occasionally turn to a cookbook to make a recipe really believe that things can happen so effortlessly.
I think it's all to do with running together cooking, understood as standing in front of the stove, and kitchen management, which is a whole set of activities, planning, shopping, storage, understanding your tools, having a repertoire of recipes, and cleaning up, which often gets forgotten. That is a very different thing from simply starting with a saucepan and a set of ingredients. It's a much more long, complex process.
Yeah, first, let's talk about negotiating the modern supermarket. We don't even think about what a time suck it is. I mean, if you're not a cook who knows exactly what you want and you've done it a million times before, when you walk into that store, you are bombarded.
I think bombarded is the perfect word. I was staggered when I looked up the figures, and there are well over 40,000 items, distinct items in a modern supermarket. And that's enough to give anybody decision fatigue, even the experienced cook. I head for the ingredients that I know I want. But even so, the whole job of the supermarket is to attract you to look at some interesting new vegetable or some nice new packaged substance. It's very easy to get bogged down in all that. I can shop in about an hour if I restrict myself to one supermarket. But how many people, in fact, do that?
I have to admit that I lean on grocery delivery services because I get less distracted. I'm like a little magpie when it comes to food. If I'm in an environment that's filled with food, it's like being in Disneyland for me.
It certainly is. And I also have gone over to grocery deliveries. But unfortunately, that just means that it frees up time for me to go to the interesting Chinese market or the farmer's market or extra markets to get specialty stuff. So I don't, in fact, save time on it.
Do you know what the average amount of time is that we spend in the supermarket and how often we tend to go?
Some of the figures I saw suggested that it was about 40 minutes to an hour a visit and that people went 1.5 times a week. I suspect it varies enormously from cook to cook.
And also, I mean, that doesn't take into account the amount of time it takes some of us to get there.
No. And then when you get home, to get everything out of the car and into the house and put away, which for me is the worst part of the job.
It's true. And I think that for some people, they may not know how to store things properly.
I think they don't. And in America, it tends to boil down to two places, the refrigerator and the closet or the pantry. And that means that a lot of stuff isn't, in fact, stored very well. Potatoes, for example, I don't think are very well stored in a refrigerator. And we create chaos by having refrigerators that are stuffed with things that probably don't need to be there, like jam.
You know, you've written so much on the act of cooking and the amount of time it takes to really put together a meal that I feel like you, more than a lot of writers, have shown kind of the heroic nature of what it takes to cook and serve a family meal, not a party meal, just a regular family meal. What do you think about these new companies like Blue Apron or Purple Carrot that have all these pre-measured ingredients delivered?
I haven't tried them out myself. I'm up for any experiment that makes home cooking easier. I still think that home cooking is probably a good option for most people because time-consuming and heroic as it is, and I think it is, to go out to eat, particularly if you have children, is an even more time-consuming and difficult activity. So if people find that these delivery services make it easier for them, I haven't tried them, that's great. Obviously, there are problems with them. They come with a lot of packaging. They don't really allow for the flexibility of somebody in the family perhaps being out or being sick the night they arrive. So I don't think they're going to be a complete replacement for the home cook who shops and prepares the meal. But, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom.
What I think, when I see those words easy or fast, I think to myself often, well, I can make something fairly simple and do it quickly. But behind my ability to do that are countless hours of food nerdery, of teaching myself how to do that.
I mean, exactly. I'm sure when you go to put on a pot of water for pasta, you know what size of pot to put on. You know instinctively how much salt to throw into the water. But those are not skills that we are born with. Those are skills we learn. Just a personal story, I grew up with a mother who cooked 7 days a week, and I knew a lot. But the first time I was on my own, I was staggered. I prepared a potato dish in the morning, and I left it. And when I came home, the potatoes were black. And I hadn't realized, even though I'd seen my mother do it 100 times, that you have to put the potatoes underwater if they're not going to turn black. Each one of these skills, but in and of itself, is just a tiny skill. But when you add them all up, it becomes quite a job of knowledge acquisition to get them all in place. And they're not there in the cookbooks very often.
It's a language, really, is what it is.
Yes, I think it is. And you have to know how to put a sequence, not of words, but of actions together so that it makes a meaning.
In your essay, you also talk about all the equipment and understanding how to use what it is that you have to their greatest effect.
Yes, I think so. I can't be the only person who has had a family member say to them, when I have left something ready to reheat with some plastic wrap over it in the refrigerator, whether you should remove the plastic wrap before you put it into the oven or the microwave. And that sounds silly, but again, why would we be born with that knowledge? Understanding the capacities of each instrument. I mean, I had to learn up an induction cooktop recently. It wasn't a vast task, but it's very different from cooking on a gas burner.
Yeah, and I think about how most of us use some of these tools. Many of us, like a microwave, for example, I bought a new microwave. Did I open the book and teach myself how to use all of the buttons? No. Do I understand how to defrost something perfectly so it isn't cooking, it's just defrosting? No. I would have to go online, re-find the manual that I'm sure I've thrown out. And I'm a skilled cook.
Exactly. And then maybe you bought beetroots and you know you can cook them in the microwave, but you've got certain other vegetables down. You know exactly what time it takes for broccoli, but you don't cook beetroots so often. So yes, are you going to overcook them?
It's fascinating to me, this accretion of minutiae that taken together means that you do things almost unthinkingly, but for the vast majority of people, they haven't been at someone's side acquiring all that knowledge.
No, and I think we're very bad at the moment about teaching kitchen management in general. If you want to learn how to actually fry an onion or prepare a beef stew, we have very good cookbooks on that. But on the whole process of how you always thinking ahead up to the next meal so that you may prepare something extra that you can use in a different way, make some extra rice so the next day you can have a rice chicken soup, how you store things, how even you clean up. Those things are simply not addressed in most of the literature.
We need to bring back home ec.
I think if we do, I was thinking about this just before the interview. People think that if we bring back Home Ec, it should be for teaching cooking. But I think since we have such a diversity of people in this country and so many different culinary traditions, what is much more important to teach people is this general structure for thinking about how to work in a kitchen, not just on a one-time basis, but on this day after day after day basis.
That's food historian Rachel Lawden. We've been discussing why home cooking isn't as easy as some might have you believe. Now a visit to the farmer's market to learn about a somewhat obscure vegetable that can lend depth to your home cooking.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting today with Richard Blaze. He is chef owner of Crack Shack and Juniper and Ivy. Those are two restaurants down in San Diego. Crack Shack, which is a chicken and egg place, is going to be opening two locations coming soon to Los Angeles. Richard, you're here at the market. You're strolling up and down. So happy to have you here. Tell me what you're inspired by and what you're going to make.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm happy to be here. And like, I'm always inspired at the market. It's the easiest place for a chef to get inspiration. I'm into like the things that you don't see a lot of in the regular grocery store, right? So there's some amazing punzarella over there, which is in the chicory family. So this is like a hearty, dare I say, bitter green that I think you can do a lot with. So I think that's what we're gonna do a recipe with. But again, as most chefs, I'm sort of just doing this on the fly. Whatever looks nice, whatever smells great, whatever's delicious, that's what we're gonna cook.
Yeah, it's kind of late winter, it's kind of spring, and we're kind of not really sure what's going on. And chicory, like you say, when you describe this punzarella, it kind of looks like stunted celery.
It does. I like it because it has that sort of body to it, because obviously it's got its leaves, and you might think of like chicory as something that's a salad, but I don't know if they're pods or blossoms, whatever they are, it's got some meat to it. So I'm thinking we're going to throw that punzarella on the grill and sort of turn it into, you know, is it a salad? Is it a side dish? Is it a main course? It doesn't even know. Like you said, we're in this really interesting part where it's spring, it's kind of winter. So I still think I want some like meatiness to this dish, even though it's going to be vegetable centric.
And some of it is leaves you would get rid of, and then some of it is the actual punzarella. So how do you slice and dice it for grilling?
Oh, wow. You know, I'm going to use all of it. First of all, I'm going to even use those outer sort of bitter leaves to probably garnish this dish. And then like the core of the punzarella, I'm going to just split in half like you would maybe a Belgian endive, a little olive oil, salt, pepper, maybe some fresh herbs. And I'm going to throw it on a nice wood-fired grill if you have that. And if not, just throw it in a cast iron pan if you're at home and you don't want to cook outside. But I really want to emphasize that sweetness will come out a little bit when it cooks and sort of gives up its bitterness.
But they're much bigger than an endive. Are you just cutting it in half? I mean, it's a pretty hefty thing.
Yeah, listen, if I'm in my restaurant at Juniper and Ivy in San Diego, we're probably going to leave those cores whole and maybe like very, as you know, very chef way, cook them on the dying embers of a wood-burning grill. Doesn't that sound very chef-like?
Sounds like you got to wait till the end of the night to do that.
Or the next morning even. It's very romantic. But at home, I'm probably going to just split that core in half so it cooks a little bit quicker. My kids are getting home from school. I have guests coming over in a couple minutes. So a way that I can expedite the cooking process.
Okay, and then you say you're dressing it just olive oil, salt, pepper. What about, you know?
Olive oil, salt, pepper for the grill.
Yeah.
Right? But then when it comes off the grill, here's what I'm thinking. We're in California. Like, is the avocado, like, it's a state thing. I feel like it's just, like, you can't be a California without loving avocados. There's some amazing winter avocados in the market right now. So I'm thinking, let's throw it back. We're using punzarella. That might be very modern for some people. Let's make a green goddess dressing, but let's do it with avocados. Let's just puree some avocados, olive oil, herbs, garlic, maybe some anchovy, and make, like, a green goddess.
Green goddess, you know, next to the Hidden Valley Ranch, that is the one thing that everybody wants to know how to make.
Yes, listen, obviously I've revealed that I also really love ranch dressing. My first job was at a fast food restaurant. I'm not ashamed of it. But Green Goddess, we're bringing it back. So here I'm just going to puree that avocado, some olive oil, some lemon juice, maybe a splash of red wine vinegar. Tarragon is key. We'll find some fresh herbs. Like, tarragon's so underutilized. I feel like tarragon is the Jackie O of herbs. It's just classy. It's regal. It's a pearl necklace of herbs. And you don't want to use too much of it. It is anise. So, you know, licorice can be off-putting to some people, but I love it.
All right, this is so exciting. We're very excited about the restaurants coming to LA. And in the meantime, if you want to go down to Richard's place down in San Diego, Crack Shack and Juniper and Ivy.
Yes, and they don't even have to wait for Crack Shack to come to Century City, because I'm doing the All-Star Chefs Classic, the Masters of Vegetables, with my friends Michael Voltaggio and Wiley Dufresne. What a an honor to be in the same sort of menu with those guys. So that's something that's happening here in LA. You can go onto the website and find out where it is, March 7th to 10th. The Vegetable Masters at LA Live.
All right, thanks a bunch, and on with the Punterella.
On we go.
I'm talking now with farmer Debbie Takakawa. She and her husband, Shu, farm the farm called The Garden of ... which is an interesting name for a farm. Kind of leaves the door open to the next adventure, as Shu explained it once. Debbie, you grow this Punterella that Chef Richard Blais was talking about. Tell us about it.
Well, Punterella is this crazy sort of like alien foreigner that nobody knows what to do with or expects to see on the table. And we always like to have something like that. I mean, our main thing that we do is grow the common vegetable uncommonly well. So having something like Punterella just adds a little bit of spice and excitement to the stand, and it gives us something to talk about. And Punterella in itself is like an incredible vegetable because it's a spring bitter. And so it's a blood purifier. It's super good for you. It's an authentic native food for Italians. It's a Roman staple, and it's just delicious.
It almost looks like something that might have originally grown by the side of the Appian Way.
It really does. It just has this wild, untamed look to it. And we harvest it when it's young and compact so that it's easy to work with and it's tender and flavorful. And it's a process.
So it grows the same time of year as other chicories, or is it unique to spring, early spring?
It's really a winter. In this area, it's a winter crop. We're actually having trouble because it's unseasonably warm right now. And so we need for it to cool back down again if we want to be able to have our full season. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's growing way too fast right now.
Do you have to plant it from seed or from little seedlings or what?
We make seedlings out of it because we do seedlings for a lot of things because we have automated weeding, and it's much easier to use the automated weeding if we have seedling transplants rather than growing by seed. So it costs money to make the transplants, but then it saves a huge amount of time, effort, and money with the weeding because the weeding is basically a tractor just breezing through the bed every couple weeks.
Right, with those amazing calibrated discs that just gets the weeds and don't pull out the little, that's amazing, yeah. So what is the season then? Punterella will start now. Does it have a long growing season? Are you succession planting it? And how long will we have it?
We do succession plant, and we should have it for 6 weeks, but if the weather stays hot, it'll back it down to maybe 3 weeks, if we're lucky, 4 weeks.
Are you going to plant any more over the summer, or you have to wait till winter?
No, it's only winter. It needs cold, short days.
Okay, well, so we can get it now at your booth here. You're here Wednesday, Santa Monica. You go to Hollywood on Sunday.
Correct.
Where else are you?
Santa Barbara on Saturday, and also on Wednesday up in Solvang.
Okay. All right, great. So, Debbie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura. That was great. Fun. Thanks.
Thank you. That was farmer Debbie Takakawa. She and her husband, Shu Takakawa, are the farmer owners over at The Garden Of in Los Olivos, and they do grow exceptionally well. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
As I was scanning my Instagram feed the other day, I saw a genius idea for using Punterella that I am ashamed to say I never thought of, which is to just strip away all the outside leaves and to just take the inner core and stick it onto a grill hole with just a little bit of olive oil and salt. Really genius idea from my friend Carol Kottner-Thompson. After the break, we close with a restaurant recommendation from our friend Jonathan Gold. Don't go anywhere.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. And now we leave you with a restaurant recommendation from my favorite restaurant critic, Jonathan Gold.
We're going to, I guess it's Rose Feed.
Does that mean dim sum?
In this case, yes, it does mean dim sum. A new place called Longo Seafood, which as far as I can tell has nothing to do with Longo Toyota, but maybe the sound of Longo is very big. Just sounds good.
So is this a family that has been operating under other names in town, or are they new?
As far as I can tell, it's a new restaurant. It's in a location that has been at least 8 or 9 different dim sum restaurants in the time I've been following it, which has been a while. This is the one that's going to work, I think, and they spent a long time renovating it. It's, as you would expect from a dim sum restaurant, you know, enormous, like airplane hangar, big. There are big fish tanks, and there is the single largest television screen you have ever seen outside a sports stadium.
And what is on the TV screen?
Usually Chinese dramas, though sometimes they've had televised concerts with the sound off completely, of course.
That's hilarious. What are we eating?
We're talking about dim sum right now, I guess, which they serve in the mornings. The evenings are Hong Kong-style seafood, big, good live food from the tanks with a specialty of pork belly that's you should probably check out. Though you can also get the pork belly in the morning for dim sum when the room is completely jammed. I think that their best things are baked buns. It's sort of what they call snow-capped buns at some restaurants. It's a style that was developed in Toronto, of all places. It involves, like, brushing the top of the bun with something that crystallizes and becomes very crisp and looks white and snowy and festive. And you can have those stuffed with all kinds of things. I mean, you know, pork, obviously, or sweetened egg things, or kaya.
How fun.
I think so.
What about the more dumpling-y dumplings?
One of the specialties there are chongfan, the rice noodles. Most places do a specific style where they're steamed and then sort of delicately wrapped around things and cut at table and drizzled with soy sauce. The kind at Longo are different. They're chewy. They're twisted like scarves a little bit. They're filled with different things like shrimp or pork or beef, of course, but also, you know, pungent dried scallops or shredded roast duck. And my favorite of them is something called the barbecue supreme rice noodle, which is stuffed with crunchy bits of their house roast pig.
I'm struck by the amount of pork we're eating at a place that has seafood in its name.
There's plenty of seafood to get. I mean, there's, you know, abalone with sea cucumber, and mostly in the evening, so you can get it at lunch, a soup of crab meat with fish maw. That's one of the better versions I've ever had. Like thick, really crabby, fresh. There's a little bit of brininess to it. And then you put a little red vinegar on it from a cruet, and it just sort of explodes with deliciousness. Even then, the dish that I can never avoid ordering at dinner is braised pork belly draped over Hakka preserved vegetables.
Oh, that sounds really good.
It's so good.
Before we go, happy Lunar New Year's. Visit the Good Food blog to read an article about the lovely Chinese New Year's dessert called Tang Yin. Writer Jean Trin visited Chang'an Restaurant in San Gabriel to see how they're made. Her photos are really spectacular. Visit blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. I also want to tell you about an exciting event I'll be part of next month. The Food Book Fair comes to LA from March 2nd through the 4th. It's been called the Coachella of writing about eating. Come and mingle with leading figures in food media, beloved chefs, and much more. On March 2nd, I'll be on a panel about the future of food media at the Ace Hotel downtown. Admission is free, like most of the events. Seats are limited, so RSVP by visiting foodbookfair.com. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Or you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Many thanks to the Good Food team. I am Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.